I'm sure you trusted me completely. You thought I could never betray you. And for betraying this trust of yours, I had no sense of guilt. I would call you from the hotel room and say that work was going to keep me out late. I piled one lie on top of another, but they caused me no pain. It seemed like the most natural thing in the world to do. My heart needed my life with you. The home I shared with you was the place where I belonged. It was the world I belonged to. But my body had this violent need for sex with him. Half of me was here, and half there. I knew that sooner or later the break would have to come, but at the time, it felt as if this double life would go on forever. Over here, I was living peacefully with you, and over there, I was making violent love with him. I want you to understand one thing at least. This was never a matter of your being sexually inferior to him or lacking in sex appeal, or my being tired of sex with you. It was just that at that time, my body experienced this violent, irrepressible hunger. I could do nothing to resist it. Why such things happen, I have no idea. All I can say is that it did happen. A few times during the weeks that I was sleeping with him, I thought about having sex with you too. It seemed unfair to me, for your sake, that I should be sleeping with him but not with you. But in your arms, I had ceased to feel anything at all. You must have noticed. For close to 2 months, I made up all kinds of excuses to avoid having sexual relations with you. But then one day, he asked me to leave you for him. We were such a perfect match, he said, that there was no reason for us not to be together. He would leave his family, he said. I asked him to give me time to think about it, but on the train home, after I left him that night, I realized that I no longer felt a thing for him. I don't understand it myself. But the moment he asked me to join him, that special something inside me disappeared, as if a strong wind had come up and blown it away. My desire for him was gone. Without a trace. That was when I started to feel guilty towards you. As I wrote earlier, I had felt nothing of the sort the whole time I was feeling intense desire for him. All I had felt was how convenient it was that you had noticed nothing. I thought I could get away with anything as long as you failed to notice. My connection with him belonged to a different world from my connection with you. After my desire for him evaporated, though, I no longer knew where I was. I've always thought of myself as an honest person. True, I have my faults. But where important things were concerned, I had never lied to anyone or deceived myself. I'd never hidden anything from you. That had been one small source of pride for me. But then for months, I went on telling you those fatal lies without a twinge of regret. That very fact is what started to torment me. It made me feel as if I were an empty, meaningless, worthless person, and in fact, that is probably what I am. But there is one other thing, in addition, that continues to bother me, and that is, how did I suddenly come to feel such intense, abnormal sexual desire for a man I didn't even love? This is what I simply cannot grasp. If it hadn't been for that desire, I would still be enjoying my happy life with you, and that man would still be a nice friend to chat with on occasion. But that feeling, that incredible, overwhelming lust, tore down everything we'd built up over the years. It took away everything that was mine. It took away you and the home that we had made together and my work. Why did such a thing have to happen? After I had my abortion 3 years ago, I told you that there was something I had to say to you. Do you remember? Perhaps I should have said it. Perhaps I should have told you everything that was in my heart before things came to this. This might never have happened if I had done so. But now that it has happened, even now, I don't believe that I would be able to tell you what I was feeling then. And that is because it seems to me that once I put it into words, things would be even more decisively ruined than they are now. Which is why I came to feel that the best thing I could do was to swallow it all and disappear. I am sorry to have to tell you this. But the fact is that I was never able to have true sexual pleasure with you, either before or after we were married. I loved it when you held me in your arms, but all I ever felt was a vague, far-off sense that almost seemed to belong to someone else. This is in no way your fault, My inability to feel was purely and simply my own responsibility. There was some kind of blockage inside me which would always hold any sexual feeling I had in check. When, for reasons I cannot grasp, that blockage was swept away by sex with him, I no longer had any idea what I should do. There was always something very close and delicate between us, you and me. It was there from the very beginning. But now it has been lost forever. That perfect meshing of the gears, that mythical something, has been destroyed. Because I destroyed it. Or, more accurately, something made me destroy it. I am terribly sorry it ever happened. Not everyone is lucky enough to have such a chance as I had with you. I hate the thing that caused all this to happen. You have no idea how much I hate it. I want to know precisely what it is. I have to know precisely what it is. I have to search out its roots and judge and punish it. I cannot be sure that I have the strength to do so, but one thing is certain. This is my problem alone. It has nothing to do with you. I have only one thing to ask of you, and that is this. Please, don't concern yourself about me anymore. Please, don't try to find me. Just forget about me, and think about beginning a new life. Where my family is concerned, I will do the proper thing. I will write to them and explain that this is all my fault, that you are in no way responsible. They will not cause you any trouble. Formal divorce proceedings will begin quite soon, I think. That will be the best for both of us. So please don't protest. Just go along with them. As far as the clothes and other things I have left behind are concerned, I'm sorry, but please just dispose of them or donate them somewhere. Everything belongs to the past now. Anything I ever used in my life with you, I have no right to use now. Goodbye.
I read the letter one more time from beginning to end and returned it to its envelope. Then I took another can of beer from the refrigerator and drank it. If Kumiko was planning to institute divorce proceedings, that meant she had no intention of killing herself right away. That gave me some relief. But then I ran up against the fact that I had not had sex with anyone for almost 2 months. As she had said in her letter, Kumiko had resisted sleeping with me all that time. She had symptoms of a mild bladder infection, she said, and the doctor had told her to refrain from sex for a while. And of course I had believed her. I had no reason not to. During those 2 months, I had had relations with women in my dreams, or in some world that within the limits of my vocabulary I could only call a dream, with Krita Kano and with the telephone woman. But now that I thought about it, 2 months had gone by since the last time I had slept with a real woman in the real world. Lying on the sofa, staring at my own hands, resting on my chest, I thought about the last time I had seen Kumiko's body. I thought about the soft curve of her back when I zipped her dress up, and the smell of cologne behind her ears. If what she said in the letter was the irrevocable truth, however, I would probably never sleep with Kumiko again. She had written it with such clarity and finality. What else could it be but the irrevocable truth? The more I thought about the possibility that my relationship with Kumiko had become a thing of the past, the more I began to miss the gentle warmth of that body that had once belonged to me. I had enjoyed sleeping with her. Of course I had enjoyed it before we were married, but even after some years had gone by and the initial thrill had faded, I enjoyed having sex with Kumiko. Her slender back, the nape of her neck, her legs, her breasts. I could recall the touch of every part of her with total vividness. I could recall all the things I had done for her and she had done for me in the course of our sexual union. But now Kumiko had joined her body with that of someone I did not know. And with an intensity I could hardly imagine. She had discovered a pleasure she had been unable to obtain from sex with me. While she was doing it with him, she had most likely squirmed and writhed enough to make the bed shake, and had released groans loud enough to be audible in the next room. She had probably done things with him that she would never have done with me. I went and opened the refrigerator, took out a beer and drank it. Then I ate some potato salad. Wanting to hear music, I turned on the FM radio, tuning into a classical station at low volume.
"I'm so tired today," Kumiko would say. "I'm just not in the mood. I'm sorry, really."
I'd answer, "That's okay, no big deal." When Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings ended, a little piano piece came on that sounded like something by Schumann. It was familiar, but I couldn't recall a title. When it was over, the female announcer said it had been the seventh of Schumann's Forest Scenes, titled Bird as Prophet. I imagined Kumiko twisting her hips beneath the other man, raising her legs, planting her fingernails in his back, drooling on the sheets. The announcer explained that Schumann had created a scene of fantasy in which a mysterious bird lived in the forest, foretelling the future. What had I ever known about Kumiko? Soundlessly, I crushed the empty beer can in my hand and threw it into the bin. Could it be true that the Kumiko I had thought I understood, the Kumiko I had held close to me and joined my body with over the years, that Kumiko was nothing but the most superficial layer of the person Kumiko herself? Just as the greater part of this world belongs to the realm of the jellyfish? If so, what about those 6 years we had spent together? What had they been? What had they meant? I was reading Kumiko's letter yet again when the phone rang. The sound shot me out of the sofa. Who could possibly be calling at 2 in the morning? Kumiko? No, she would never call here. Probably Mei Kasahara. She had seen me leave the empty house and decided to give me a call. Or possibly Krita Kano. She wanted to explain why she had disappeared. It could be the telephone woman. She might be trying to convey a message to me. Mei Kasahara had been right. There were just a few too many women around me. I wiped the sweat from my face with a towel that lay nearby, and when I was ready, I picked up the receiver. "Hello?" I said.
"Hello?"
came the voice from the other end. It did not belong to Mei Kasahara. Neither was it Krita Kano's voice, or the voice of the enigmatic woman. It was Malta Kano.
"Hello?" she said. "Is that Mr. Okada? My name is Malta Kano. I wonder if you remember me."
"Of course, I remember you very well," I said, trying to still the pounding of my heart. How could I not have remembered her?
"I must apologize for telephoning you so late at night. This is something of an emergency, however. I fully recognized what a rude intrusion this would be, and how angry it would make you, but I felt compelled to call nevertheless. I am terribly sorry."
She need not be concerned. I assured her I was up in any case and not the least bit bothered. 12. Discovered when shaving. Discovered when waking.
"The reason I am calling you so late at night, Mr. Okada, is that I felt I ought to reach you at the earliest possible opportunity," said Malta Kano.
Listening to her speak, I had the impression that she was choosing and arranging each word into well-ordered sentences according to strict principles of logic, which is what she always did.
"If you have no objection, there are several questions that I wish to be permitted to ask you, Mr. Okada. May I proceed?"
Receiver in hand, I lowered myself onto the sofa. "Go right ahead. Ask me anything you like," I said.
"Have you by any chance been away these past 2 days, Mr. Okada? I tried telephoning you any number of times, but you seemed always to be out."
"Well, yes, I was out. I wanted to get away from the house for a while. I needed to be alone to do some thinking. I've got lots of things I need to think about."
"Yes, Mr. Okada, I'm very much aware of that. I understand how you feel. A change of scene can be a very good thing when one wishes to think clearly and carefully about something. In this case, however, Mr. Okada, and I know this will sound as if I am prying, were you not somewhere very far away?"
"Well, not so very far away," I said with deliberate ambiguity. I switched the receiver from my left hand to my right. "How can I put this? I was in a somewhat cut-off place. I really can't go into it, though, in great detail. I have my reasons, and I only got back a little while ago. I'm too tired for long explanations.
Of course, Mr. Okada, I understand. Everyone has their reasons. I will not press you to explain. You must be very tired indeed. I can tell from the sound of your voice. Please do not concern yourself about me. I should not be bothering you with a lot of questions at a time like this. I am terribly sorry. We can always discuss this matter at a more appropriate time. I know it was terribly rude of me to ask such a personal question, but I do so only because I was worried that something very bad had happened to you over the past few days.
I tried to make an appropriate response, but the little noise that came from my throat sounded less like a response than the gasp of an aquatic animal that had breathed the wrong way. Something very bad, I thought. Of all the things that were happening to me, which were bad, and which were not bad? Which were all right, and which were not all right? Thank you for being so concerned about me, I said, getting my voice to work properly. But I'm fine at the moment. I can't say that something good has happened to me, but there's been nothing especially bad either.
I am glad to hear that.
I'm just tired, that's all, I added. Multicano made a dainty little sound of clearing her throat.
By the way, Mr. Okada, I wonder if you might have noticed any major physical change during the past few days?
A physical change? In me?
Yes, Mr. Okada, some kind of change in your body.
I raised my face and looked at my reflection in the glass patio door, but I couldn't make out anything that could be called a physical change. I had scrubbed every part of my body in the shower, but had noticed nothing then either. What kind of change did you have in mind? I asked.
I have no idea what it might be, but it should be very obvious to anyone who looks at you.
I stretched my left hand open on the table and stared at the palm, but it was just my usual palm. It had not changed in any way that I could perceive. It had not become covered in gold foil, nor had it developed webs between the fingers. It was neither beautiful nor ugly. When you say that it should be very obvious to anyone who looks at me, what do you mean? Something like wings sprouting on my back?
It could be something like that,
said Multicano in her usual even tone.
Of course, I mean that as one possibility.
Of course, I said.
So then, have you noticed some such change?
Not really. Not so far, at least. I mean, if wings had sprouted on my back, I couldn't help but notice, don't you think?
Of course,
said Multicano.
But do be careful, Mr. Okada. To know one's own state is not a simple matter. One cannot look directly at one's own face with one's own eyes, for example. One has no choice but to look at one's reflection in the mirror. Through experience, we come to believe that the image is correct, but it is just a belief.
I'll be careful, I said.
I do have one more thing I would like to ask you, Mr. Okada. For some time now, I have been unable to establish contact with my sister Krita, just as I lost contact with you. It may be a coincidence, but I find it very strange. I was wondering if, perhaps, you might have some knowledge of the circumstances behind this.
Krita Kano?
Yes,
said Multicano.
Does anything come to mind in that regard?
No, nothing came to mind, I replied. I had no clear basis for thinking so, but I felt that for the time being, it would be better if I said nothing to Multicano about the fact that I had not long ago spoken with Krita Kano in person, and that immediately afterwards she had disappeared. It was just a feeling.
Krita was worried about having lost contact with you, Mr. Okada. She went out last night, saying that she planned to visit your home and see what she could find there, but even at this late hour she has not returned, and for some reason I can no longer sense her presence.
I see. Well, if she should happen to come here, I'll tell her to contact you right away, I said. Multicano remained silent for some time.
To tell you the truth, Mr. Okada, I am worried about Krita. As you know, the work that she and I do is far from ordinary. But she is not as well versed in matters of that world as I am. I do not mean to imply that she is not gifted. In fact, she is very gifted. But she is not yet fully acclimatized to her gift.
I see. Maltacano fell silent once again. This silence was longer than the last one. I sensed a certain indecision on her part. Hello? Are you still there? I asked.
Yes, Mr. Okada, I am still here, she replied.
If I see Krita, I'll be sure to tell her to get in touch with you, I said again.
Thank you very much, said Maltacano.
Then, after apologizing for the late-night call, she hung up. I hung up too, and looked at my reflection in the glass one more time. Then the thought struck me. I might never speak with Maltacano again. This could be the last contact I would ever have with her. She could disappear from my life forever. I had no special reason for thinking this. It was just a feeling that came to me. Suddenly, I thought about the rope ladder. I had left it hanging down the well. The sooner I retrieved it, the better. Problems could arise if someone found it there. And then there was the sudden disappearance of Krita Kano. I had last seen her at the well. I shoved my torch into my pocket, put on my shoes, stepped down into the garden, and climbed over the wall again. Then I passed down the alley to the vacant house. Mei Kazahara's house was pitch dark. The hands of my watch were nearing 3 a.m. I entered the yard of the vacant house and headed straight for the well. The rope ladder was still anchored to the base of the tree and hanging down into the well, which was still just half open. Something prompted me to peer down into the well and call Krita Kano's name in a kind of whispered shout. There was no answer. I pulled out my torch and aimed it down the well. The beam did not reach bottom, but I heard a tiny moaning sound. I tried calling the name again.
"It's all right. I'm here," said Krita Kano.
"What are you doing in a place like this?"
I asked in a low voice.
"What am I doing? I'm doing the same thing you were doing, Mr. Okada," she replied with obvious puzzlement. "I'm thinking. This really is a perfect place for thinking, isn't it?"
"Well, yes, I guess it is," I said. "But your sister called me at home a little while ago. She's very worried about you. It's the middle of the night, and you're still not home, and she says she can't feel your presence. She wanted me to tell you to get in touch with her right away if I heard from you."
"I see. Well, thank you for taking the trouble."
"Never mind about that, Krita Kano. Will you do me a favor and come out of there? I have to talk to you."
She did not reply. I switched off my torch and returned it to my pocket.
"Why don't you come down here, Mr. Okada? The two of us could sit here and talk."
It might not be a bad idea, I thought, to climb down into the well again and talk with Krita Kano, but then I thought about the moldy darkness at the bottom of the well and got a heavy feeling in my stomach.
"No, sorry, but I'm not going down there again, and you ought to come out, too. Somebody might pull the ladder up again, and the air is stale."
"I know that, but I want to stay down here a little longer. Don't worry yourself about me."
There was nothing I could do as long as Krita Kano had no intention of coming out of the well.
"When I talked to your sister on the phone, I didn't tell her I saw you here. I hope that was the right thing to do. I just had this feeling that it'd be better to say nothing."
"You were right," said Krita Kano. "Please don't tell my sister I am here."
A moment later she added,
"I don't want to worry her, but I need a chance to think sometimes too. I will come out as soon as I am done. I would like to be alone now, if you would be so kind. I will not cause you any trouble."
I decided to leave her and go back to the house for the time being. I could come in the morning and check up on her. If Mei Kazahara pulled the ladder up again during the night, I could deal with the situation then and help Krita Kano climb out of the well one way or another. I went home, undressed, and stretched out in bed. Picking up the book I had been reading, I opened it. I was too much on edge to get to sleep right away, but before I had read 2 full pages, I realized I was dozing off. I closed the book, turned out the light, and the next moment was sound asleep. It was 9:30 in the morning by the time I awoke. Concerned about Krita Kano, I dressed without bothering to wash my face and hurried down the alley to the vacant house. The clouds hung low in the sky, and the humid morning air seemed to threaten rain at any moment. The rope ladder was gone from the well. Someone must have untied it from the base of the tree and carried it off somewhere. Both halves of the well cover were set tightly in place, with a stone on each half. Opening one side and peering down into the well, I called Krita Kano's name. There was no answer. I tried a few more times, waiting after each call. Thinking she might be asleep, I tossed a few pebbles inside, but there no longer seemed to be any body at the bottom of the well. Krita Kano must have climbed out of the well when morning came, untied the ladder, and taken it with her. I set the cover in place and moved away from the well. In the alley again, I leaned against the fence of the vacant house, watching Mei Kasahara's house for a time. I thought she might notice me there, as she usually did, and come out, but there was no sign of her. All around was silence. No people, no noises of any kind, not even the cry of a cicada. I passed the time digging at the surface of the ground with the toe of my shoe. Something felt different about the neighborhood, unfamiliar, as if in the days I was down in the well the old reality of this place had been supplanted by a new reality, which had settled in and taken over. I had been feeling this somewhere deep down ever since I had emerged from the well and gone home. Walking back down the alley to my house, I went into the bathroom and brushed my teeth. Several days' worth of black stubble covered my face. I looked like a newly rescued shipwreck victim. This was the first time in my life I had ever let my beard grow so long. I toyed with the idea of really letting it grow, but after a few moments' thought, decided to shave it. For some reason, it just seemed better to keep the face I had had when Kumiko left. I softened up my beard with a hot towel and covered my face with a thick layer of shaving cream. I then proceeded to shave, slowly and carefully, so as to avoid cutting myself. First the chin, then the left cheek, then the right cheek. As I was finishing the right cheek, what I saw in the mirror made me catch my breath. It was a blue-black stain of some kind. At first I thought I might have smeared myself with something by accident. I wiped off the remaining traces of shaving cream, gave my face a good wash with soap and water, and scrubbed the stained area with a flannel. But still the stain would not come off. It seemed to have penetrated deep into the skin. I stroked it with a finger. That one patch of skin felt just a little warmer than the rest of my face, but otherwise it had no particular feeling. It was a mark. I had a mark on my cheek in the exact location where in the well I had had the sensation of heat. I brought my face up to the mirror and examined the mark with the utmost care. Located just beyond the right cheekbone, it was about the size of an infant's palm. Its bluish color was close to black, like the blue-black Mont Blanc ink that Kumiko always used. One possible explanation was that this was an allergic reaction. I might have come in contact with something in the well that caused an eruption of the skin, the way lacquer can do. But what could there have been down there, in the bottom of the well, to cause such a thing? I had examined every nook and cranny of the place with my torch, finding nothing there but the dirt bottom and the concrete wall. Besides, did allergies or eruptions ever leave such well-defined marks? A mild panic overtook me. For a few moments I lost all sense of direction, as when a huge wave crashes over you on the beach, dragging you in. The flannel fell from my hand. I knocked over the wastebasket and stubbed my foot against something, mumbling meaningless syllables all the while. Then I managed to regain my composure and, leaning against the sink, began thinking calmly about how to deal with this fact. The best thing I could do for now was to wait and see. I could always go to a doctor later. It might be a temporary condition, something that would heal itself, like a lacquer eruption. It had formed in a few short days, so it might disappear just as quickly. I went to the kitchen and made myself some coffee. I was hungry, but whenever I tried to eat anything, my appetite would vanish like water in a mirage. I stretched out on the sofa and watched the rain that had begun to fall. Every now and then I would go to the bathroom and look in the mirror, but I could see no change in the mark. It had dyed that area of my cheek a deep, dark, almost handsome, blue. I could think of only one thing that might have caused this, and that was my having passed through the wall in my pre-dawn dreamlike illusion in the well, with the telephone woman leading me by the hand. She had pulled me through the wall so that we could escape from the dangerous someone who had opened the door and was coming into the room. The moment I passed through the wall, I had had the clear sensation of heat on my cheek, in the exact spot where I now had this mark. Of course, whatever casual connection there might be between my passing through the wall and the forming of a mark on my face remained unestablished. The man without a face had spoken to me in the hotel lobby.
"This is the wrong time," he had warned me.
"You don't belong here now."
But I had ignored his warning and continued on. I was angry at Noboru Wataya, angry at my own confusion, and as a result perhaps I had received this mark. Or the mark could be a brand that had been left on me by that strange dream or illusion or whatever it was. "That was no dream," they were telling me through the mark. "It really happened, and every time you look in the mirror now, you will be forced to remember it." I shook my head. Too many things were being left unexplained. The one thing I understood for sure was that I didn't understand a thing. A dull throbbing started in my head. I couldn't think anymore. I felt no urge to do anything. I took a sip of lukewarm coffee and went on watching the rain. That afternoon, I called my uncle for a chat. I needed to talk to someone. It didn't matter much who. About this feeling I had that I was being ripped away from the world of reality. When he asked how Kumiko was doing, I said fine and let it go at that. She was on a short business trip at the moment, I added. I could have told him what had really been happening, but to put recent events into some kind of order that would make sense to a third party would have been impossible. They didn't make much sense to me, so how could I explain them to someone else? I decided to keep the truth from my uncle for the time being.
"You used to live in this house, didn't you?" I asked.
"Sure did," he said. 6 or 7 years altogether. Wait a minute. I bought the place when I was 35 and lived there till I was 42. 7 years. Moved into this condo when I got married. I lived there alone all that time."
"I was just wondering, did anything bad happen to you while you were here?"
"Anything bad? Like what?"
"Like you became ill, or you split up with a woman or something?"
My uncle gave a hearty laugh.
"I split up with more than one woman, that's for sure. But not just while I was living there. Nah, I couldn't count that as anything especially bad. Nobody I hated to lose, to tell you the truth. As far as illness goes, no, I don't think so. I had a small growth removed from the back of my neck, but that's about all I remember. The barber found it. Said I ought to have it removed just to be safe, so I went to the doctor, but it turned out to be nothing much. That was the first time I went to see the doctor while I was living in that house, and the last. I ought to get a rebate on my health insurance."
"No bad memories you associate with the place, then?"
"Nope, none,"
said my uncle, after he had thought about it for a moment.
"But what's this about all of a sudden?"
"Nothing much,"
I said.
"Kumiko saw a fortune teller the other day and came home with an earful about this house, that it's unlucky, things like that," I lied. "I think it's nonsense, but I promised to ask you about it."
What do they call it? House physiognomy? I don't know anything about that stuff, but I've lived in the place and my impression is that it's okay. It doesn't have any problems. Miyawaki's place is another matter, of course, but you're pretty far away from there."
"What kind of people lived here after you moved out?" I asked.
"Let's see. After me, a school teacher and his family lived there for 3 years, and then a young couple for 5 years. He ran some kind of business, but I don't remember what it was. I can't swear that everybody lived a happy life in that house. I had a property agent managing the place for me. I never met the people, and I don't know why they moved out, but I never heard about anything bad that happened to any of them. I just assumed the place got a little small for them, and they wanted to build their own homes, that kind of thing.
Somebody once told me that the flow of this place has been obstructed. Does that ring a bell?
The flow has been obstructed?
I don't know what it means either, I said. It's just what they told me.
My uncle thought it over for a while.
No, nothing comes to mind. But it might have been a bad idea to fence off both ends of the alley. A road without an entrance or exit is a strange thing when you stop to think about it. The fundamental principle of things like roads and rivers is for them to flow. Block them and they stagnate.
I see what you mean, I said. Now, there's one more thing I need to ask you. Did you ever hear the cry of the wind-up bird in this neighborhood?
The wind-up bird?
Said my uncle.
What's that?
I explained about the wind-up bird, how it came to the tree at the back once a day and made that spring-winding cry.
That's news to me, he said. I've never seen or heard one. I like birds, and I've always made a point of listening to their calls, but this is the first time I've ever heard of such a thing. You mean it has something to do with the house?
No, not really. I was just wondering if you'd ever heard of it.
You know, if you really want the lowdown on things like this, the people who lived there after me and that kind of stuff, you ought to talk to old Mr. Ichikawa, the property agent across from the station. That's Setagaya Daiichi Realtors. Tell him I sent you. He handled that house for me for years. He's been living in the neighborhood since the year Dot, and he just might tell you everything you'd ever want to know. He's the one who told me about the Miyawaki house. He's one of those old guys that love to talk. You ought to go see him.
Thanks, I will, I said.
So anyway, how's the job hunt going?
Nothing yet. To tell you the truth, I haven't been looking very hard. Kumiko's working, and I'm taking care of the house, and we're managing for now.
My uncle seemed to be thinking about something for a few moments. Then he said,
Let me know if it ever gets to the point where you just can't make it. I might be able to give you a hand.
Thanks, I said. I will.
And so our conversation ended. I thought about calling the old property agent and asking him about the background of this house and about the people who had lived here before me, but it seemed ridiculous even to be thinking about such nonsense. I decided to forget it. The rain kept falling at the same gentle rate throughout the afternoon, wetting the roofs of the houses, wetting the trees in the yards, wetting the earth. I had toast and soup for lunch and spent the rest of the afternoon on the sofa. I wanted to do some shopping, but the thought of the mark on my face made me hesitate. I was sorry I hadn't let my beard grow. I still had some vegetables in the refrigerator, and there were some cans in the cupboard. I had rice and I had eggs. I could feed myself for another 2 or 3 days if I kept my expectations low. Lying on the sofa, I didn't think about anything. I read a book, I listened to a classical music tape, I stared out at the rain falling in the garden. My cogitative powers seemed to have reached an all-time low, thanks perhaps to that long period of all-too-concentrated thinking in the dark well bottom. If I tried to think seriously about anything, I felt a dull ache in my head, as if it were being squeezed in the jaws of a padded vice. If I tried to recall anything, every muscle and nerve in my body seemed to creak with the effort. I felt I had turned into the Tin Man from the Wizard of Oz, my joints rusted and in need of oil. Every now and then I would go to the lavatory and examine the mark on my face, but it remained unchanged. It neither spread nor shrank. The intensity of its color neither increased nor decreased. At one point, I noticed that I had left some hair unshaved on my upper lip. In my confusion at discovering the mark on my right cheek, I had forgotten to finish shaving. I washed my face again, spread on shaving cream, and took off what was left. In the course of my occasional trips to the mirror, I thought of what Malta Cano had said on the phone, that I should be careful, that through experience we come to believe that the image in the mirror is correct. To make certain, I went to the bedroom and looked at my face in the full-length mirror that Kumiko used whenever she got dressed. But the mark was still there. It was not just something caused by the other mirror. I was unaware of any physical abnormality, apart from the mark. I took my temperature, but it was the same as always. Other than the fact that I felt a little hunger for someone who had not eaten in almost 3 days, and that I experienced slight nausea every now and then, which was probably a continuation of what I had felt at the bottom of the well, my body was entirely normal. The afternoon was a quiet one. The phone never rang, no letters arrived, no one came down the alley, no voices of neighbors disturbed the stillness, no cats crossed the garden, no birds came and called. Now and then a cicada would cry, but not with the usual intensity. I began to feel hungry just before 7 o'clock, so I fixed myself a dinner of tinned food and vegetables. I listened to the evening news on the radio for the first time in ages, but nothing special had been happening in the world. Some teenagers had been killed in an accident on the expressway when the driver of their car had failed in an attempt to pass another car and crashed into a wall. The branch manager and staff of a major bank were under police investigation in connection with an illegal loan they had made. A 36-year-old housewife from Machida had been beaten to death with a hammer by a young man in the street. But these were all events from some other distant world. The only thing happening in my world was the rain falling in the yard, soundlessly, gently. When the clock showed 9, I moved from the sofa to bed, and after finishing a chapter of the book I had started, I turned out the light and went to sleep. I awoke with a start in the middle of some kind of dream. I could not remember what had been happening in the dream, but it was clear it had been filled with tension, because my heart was pounding. The room was still pitch dark. For a while after I awoke, I could not remember where I was. It was quite some time before I realized that I was in my own house, in my own bed. The hands of the alarm clock showed it to be just after 2 in the morning. My irregular sleeping habits in the well were probably responsible for these unpredictable cycles of sleep and wakefulness. Once my confusion died down, I felt the need to pee. It was probably the beer I'd drunk. I would have preferred to go back to sleep, but I had no choice in the matter. When I resigned myself to the fact and sat up in bed, my hand brushed against the skin of the person sleeping next to me. This came as no surprise. That was where Kumiko always slept. I was used to having someone sleeping by my side. But then I realized that Kumiko was no longer with me. She had left. Some other person was sleeping next to me. I held my breath and turned on the light by the bed. It was Krita Kano. 13. Krita Kano's story continued. Krita Kano was stark naked. Facing my side of the bed, she lay there asleep with nothing on, not even a cover, revealing 2 well-shaped breasts, 2 small pink nipples, and below a perfectly flat stomach, a black triangle of pubic hair, looking like a shaded area in a drawing. Her skin was very white, with a newly minted glow. At a loss to explain her presence here, I nevertheless went on staring at her beautiful body. She had her knees tight together and slightly bent, her legs in perfect alignment. Her hair fell forward, covering half her face, which made it impossible for me to see her eyes. But she was obviously in a deep sleep. My turning on the bedside lamp had caused not the slightest tremble, and her breathing was quiet and regular. I was now wide awake through. I took a thin summer spread from the wardrobe and placed it over her. Then I turned out the lamp, and still in my pajamas, went to the kitchen to sit at the table for a while. I recalled my mark. That patch on my cheek was still warm to the touch. The mark was still there, all right, I had no need to look in the mirror. It wasn't the kind of insignificant thing that just disappears by itself overnight. I thought about looking up a nearby dermatologist in the phone book when it became light, but how could I answer if a doctor asked me what I thought the cause might be? I was in a well for 2 or 3 days. No, it had nothing to do with work or anything. I was just there to do a little thinking. I reckoned the bottom of a well would be a good place for that. No, I didn't take any food with me. No, it wasn't on my property. It belonged to another house, a vacant house in the neighborhood. I went in without permission. I sighed. I could never say these things to anyone, of course. I rested my elbows on the table and, without really intending to, found myself thinking in vivid detail about Krita Kano's naked body. She was sound asleep in my bed. I thought about the time in my dream when I joined my body with hers as she wore Kumiko's dress. I still had a clear impression of the touch of her skin, the weight of her flesh. Without a step-by-step investigation of that event, I would not be able to distinguish the point at which the real ended and the unreal took over. The wall separating the two regions had begun to melt. In my memory, at least, the real and the unreal seemed to be residing together with equal weight and vividness. I had joined my body with Krita Kano's, and at the same time, I had not. To clear my head of these jumbled sexual images, I had to go to the basin and splash my face with cold water. A little while later, I looked in on Krita Kano. She was still sound asleep. She had pushed the cover down to her waist. From where I stood, I could see only her back. It reminded me of my last view of Kumiko's back. Now that I thought about it, Krita Kano's figure was strikingly similar to Kumiko's. I had failed to notice the resemblance until now because their hair and their taste in clothes and their makeup were so utterly different. They were the same height and appeared to be about the same weight. They probably wore the same dress size. I carried my own summer quilt to the living room, stretched out on the sofa, and opened my book. I had been reading a history book from the library. It was all about Japanese management of Manchuria before the war and the battle with the Soviets in Nomonhan. Lieutenant Mamiya's story had aroused my interest in continental affairs of the period, and I had borrowed several books on the subject. Now, however, less than 10 minutes into the detailed historical narrative, I was falling asleep. I laid the book on the floor, intending to rest my eyes for a few moments, but I fell into a deep sleep, with the lights still on. A sound from the kitchen woke me up. When I went to investigate, Krita Kano was there, making breakfast, wearing a white t-shirt and blue shorts, both of which belonged to Kumiko.
"Where are your clothes?"
I demanded, standing in the kitchen door.
"Oh, I'm sorry. You were asleep, so I took the liberty of borrowing some of your wife's clothing. I know it was terribly forward of me, but I didn't have a thing to wear,"
said Krita Kano, turning just her head to look at me. At some point since I last saw her, she had reverted to her usual 60s style of hair and makeup, lacking only the fake eyelashes.
"That's no problem," I said. "What I want to know is what happened to your clothes?"
"I lost them,"
she said simply.
"Lost them?"
"Yes. I lost them somewhere."
I stepped into the kitchen and watched, leaning against the table, as Krita Kano made an omelet. With deft movements, she cracked the eggs, added seasoning, and beat the mixture.
"Meaning you came here naked?"
"Yes, that is correct,"
said Krita Kano, as if it were the most natural thing in the world.
"I was completely naked. You know that, Mr. Okada. You put the cover on me."
"True enough," I mumbled. "But what I'd like to know is, where and how did you lose your clothing, and how did you manage to get here with nothing on?"
"I don't know any more than you do,"
said Krita Kano, shaking the frying pan to fold the omelet over on itself.
"You don't know any more than I do?"
I repeated. Krita Kano slipped the omelet onto a plate and garnished it with a few stalks of freshly steamed broccoli. She had also made toast, which she set on the table along with coffee. I put out the butter and salt and pepper. Then, like a newly married couple, we sat down to breakfast, facing each other. It was then that I remembered my mark. Greta Kano had shown no surprise when she looked at me, and she asked me nothing about it. I reached up to touch the spot and found it slightly warm, as before.
"Does that hurt, Mr. Okada?"
"No, not at all," I said. Greta Kano stared at my face.
"It looks like a mark,"
she said. "It looks like a mark to me, too," I said. "I'm wondering whether I should show it to a doctor or not."
"It strikes me as something that a doctor would not be able to help with."
"You may be right," I said, "but I can't just ignore it." Fork in hand, Greta Kano thought for a moment.
"If you have shopping or other business, I could do it for you. You can stay inside as long as you like if you would rather not go out."
"I'm grateful for the offer, but you must have your own things to do, and I can't just stay holed up here forever." Greta Kano thought about that for a while, too.
"Malta Kano would probably know how to deal with this."
"Would you mind getting in touch with her for me, then?"
"Malta Kano gets in touch with other people, but she does not allow people to get in touch with her."
Greta Kano bit into a piece of broccoli. "But you can get in touch with her, I'm sure."
"Of course. We're sisters."
"Well, next time you talk to her, why don't you ask her about my mark? Or you could ask her to get in touch with me."
"I'm sorry, but that is something I cannot do. I'm not allowed to approach my sister on someone else's behalf. It's a sort of rule we have."
Buttering my toast, I let out a sigh.
"You mean to say, if I have something I need to talk to Malta Kano about, all I can do is wait for her to get in touch with me?"
"That is exactly what I mean,"
said Greta Kano. Then she nodded.
"But about that mark, unless it hurts or itches, I suggest that you forget about it for a while. I never let things like that bother me, and you should not let it bother you either, Mr. Okada. People just get these things sometimes."
"I wonder," I said. For several minutes after that, we went on eating our breakfast in silence. I hadn't eaten breakfast with another person for quite a while now, and this breakfast was particularly delicious. Greta Kano seemed pleased when I told her this.
"Anyhow," I said, "about your clothes."
"Does it bother you that I put on your wife's clothing without permission?"
she asked with obvious concern.
"No, not at all. I don't care what you wear of Kumiko's. She left them here, after all. What I'm concerned about is how you lost your own clothes."
"And not just my clothes. My shoes, too."
"So how did it happen?"
"I can't remember,"
said Greta Kano.
"All I know is I woke up in your bed with nothing on. I can't remember what happened before that."
"You did go down into the well, didn't you, after I left?"
"That I do remember, and I fell asleep down there. But I can't remember anything after that."
"Which means you don't have any recollection of how you got out of the well?"
"None at all. There is a gap in my memory."
Greta Kano held up both index fingers, about 8 inches apart. How much time that was supposed to represent, I had no idea.
"I don't suppose you remember what you did with the rope ladder, either. It's gone, you know."
"I don't know anything about the ladder. I don't even remember if I climbed it to get out of the well."
I stared at the coffee cup in my hand for a time.
"Do you mind showing me the bottoms of your feet?" I asked.
"No, not at all," said Greta Kano.
She sat down in the chair next to mine and stretched her legs out in my direction so that I could see the soles of her feet. I took her ankles in my hands and examined her soles. They were clean, beautifully formed. The soles had not a mark on them, no cuts, no mud, nothing at all.
"No mud, no cuts," I said.
"I see," said Greta Kano.
"It was raining all day yesterday. If you lost your shoes somewhere and walked here from there, you should have mud on your feet, and you must have come in through the garden. But your feet are clean, and there's no mud anywhere."
"I see."
"Which means you didn't walk here barefoot from anywhere."
Greta Kano inclined her head to one side as if impressed.
This is all logically consistent, she said.
It may be logically consistent, but it's not getting us anywhere, I said. Where did you lose your clothes, including your shoes, and how did you walk here from there?
Kritikano shook her head.
I have no idea, she said.
While she stood at the sink, absorbed in washing the dishes, I stayed at the kitchen table, thinking about these things. Of course, I had no idea either. Do these things happen to you often, that you can't remember where you've been? I asked.
This is not the first time that something like this has happened to me, when I can't recall where I have been or what I was doing. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen to me now and then. I once lost some clothes, too, but this is the first time I've lost all my clothes and my shoes and everything.
Kritikano turned off the water and wiped the table with a dishcloth.
You know, Kritikano, I said, you haven't told me your whole story. Last time you broke off in the middle and disappeared, remember? If you don't mind, I'd like to hear the rest. You told me how the mob got hold of you and made you work as one of their prostitutes, but you didn't tell me what happened after you met Noboru Wataya and slept with him.
Kritikano leaned against the kitchen sink and looked at me. Drops of water on her hands ran down her fingers and fell to the floor. The shape of her nipples showed clearly through the white T-shirt, a vivid reminder of the naked body I had seen the night before.
All right, then. I'll tell you everything that happened after that. Right now.
Kritikano sat down once again in the seat opposite mine.
The reason I left that day, when I was in the middle of my story, Mr. Okada, is that I was not prepared to tell it all. I had started my story because I felt I ought to tell you, as honestly as possible, what really happened to me. But I found I could not go all the way to the end. You must have been shocked when I disappeared so suddenly.
Kritikano put her hands on the table and looked straight at me as she spoke.
Well, yes, I was shocked, though it was not the most shocking thing that's happened to me lately.
As I told you before, the very last customer I had as a prostitute of the flesh was Noboru Wataya. The second time I met him, as a client of Multicano's, I recognized him immediately. It would have been impossible for me to forget him. Whether he remembered me or not, I cannot be certain. Mr. Wataya is not a person who shows his feelings. But let me go back and put things in order. First, I will tell you about the time I had Noboru Wataya as a customer. That would be 6 years ago. As I told you before, I was in a state at that time in which I had no perception of pain at all. And not only pain, I had no sensations of any kind. I lived in a bottomless numbness. Of course, I don't mean to say that I wasn't able to feel any sensations at all. I knew when something was hot or cold or painful. But these sensations came to me as if from a distance, from a world that had nothing to do with me. Which is why I felt no resistance to the idea of having sexual relations with men for money. No matter what anyone did to me, the sensations I felt did not belong to me. My unfeeling flesh was not my flesh. Now, let's see. I told you about how I had been recruited by the mob's prostitution ring. When they told me to sleep with men, I did it, and when they paid me, I accepted it. I left off at that point.
I nodded to her.
That day, they told me to go to a room on the 16th floor of a downtown hotel. The client had the unusual name of Wataya. I knocked on the door and went in to find the man sitting on the sofa. He appeared to have been drinking room service coffee while reading a book. He wore a green polo shirt and brown cotton trousers. His hair was short, and he wore brown framed glasses. On the coffee table in front of him were his cup and a coffee pot and the book. He seemed to have been deeply absorbed in his reading. There was a kind of excitement still in his eyes. His features were in no way remarkable, but those eyes of his had an energy that was almost weird. When I first saw them, I thought for a moment that I was in the wrong room. But it was not the wrong room. The man told me to come inside, and lock the door. Still seated on the sofa, without saying a word, he ran his eyes over my body, from head to foot. That was what usually happened when I entered a client's room. Most men would look me over. "Excuse me for asking, Mr. Okada.